John 9, the 10th talk in a series entitled The Gospel of John, was presented by Ron Julian on August 24, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, good morning. We're continuing in our series in the Gospel of John. We're in chapter 9 today. I'm going to see the story of the man born blind, which is... I discovered in getting ready for this, I like this story. I like this story quite a bit. It's a very typical story in John's Gospel from what we have been seeing as we've been going along. There is a miraculous sign, and then we see the way various people respond to that sign. As we've been seeing in John, John really focuses throughout the Gospel on this issue of signs and testimony that form the basis for believing that Jesus is the Christ and finding life. But then the issue is, how do people respond to that? What is the nature of belief? Where does that come from? What does it look like? And what is the nature of unbelief? And where does that come from? And what does it look like? And we're going to see more of that in this story today. There's an interesting feature to this story, I think. We're going to see the man born blind in this story being confronted with a choice. There are two voices calling to him ultimately. There is the voice that he has grown up with of religious authority, and then there is this new voice, the voice of Christ, and he's going to have to choose which voice he's going to listen to. So we'll start with the first verse in chapter 9. Actually, we'll be going into chapter 10 as well. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said these things, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Okay, so we have Jesus encountering this man. He has been blind his entire life. He was born blind. And as we're going to see, Jesus is going to very deliberately use the idea of physical blindness as a metaphor for spiritual blindness. On the physical level, this is the story of a miracle where Jesus restores the sight of a blind man. But more importantly, this is the story of a man who comes to see the truth, as we're going to see, and the story of others who do not come to see that same truth. So the blindness that we're talking about in this story is going to be more importantly a question of understanding. Do I actually see and understand the truth of God? So first of all, looking at his physical blindness in the story, the disciples pointed out to Jesus and they're puzzled. This man has been blind his whole life. And blindness is a misfortune. Surely it must be some sort of a punishment from God for something. But he's always been blind, so how should we understand this? Was it his parents who sinned, and that's why he was born blind? Could it be that maybe somehow he just, from the very beginning, he was some sort of monstrous sinner who sinned right from the womb and was immediately struck with blindness? How should we understand this, Jesus? The disciples had what was a very common belief that is in fact reflected in most of the religions of the world, that misfortune is a sign that God is mad at you. If there is something wrong in your life, that indicates that the powers that be are not happy with you. How do we avoid suffering? We make the gods happy. And this has been a belief of mankind really from the beginning. And if we're suffering, then that must be indication that the gods are not happy with us. And we can see this going all the way back to the story of Job in the Old Testament. God, for his own reasons, decides to afflict Job, and Job's friends immediately assume, well, this must be a punishment. You've done something wrong. So you need to repent so that God will stop beating you up. One of the lessons of the book of Job is that God has his own reasons for what he brings into our lives. Hardship is not necessarily a sign that God is unhappy with us. We shouldn't presume that we know what God's motives are, that we've figured out why God is doing something. Very often we don't know why God is doing the things that he does. In this case, it's interesting, Jesus actually answers the question, why did this happen to him? It's not because he sinned, or it's not because his parents sinned, but there is a purpose. He was blind so that the works of God might be displayed in him. That is, God's purpose, at least in part, was for him to be blind throughout the whole first part of his life so that Jesus might heal him for the second part of his life. The disciples were wrong in thinking that they had figured out why God had done this. It was not a punishment. It was, in fact, part of what turns out to be a redemptive purpose in his life. And afterwards, then, I want to come back and talk about that idea more, clarify a little bit what's going on there. But let's just leave that there for now. Jesus says that he has a work to do in this man's life. And he makes a claim that we've seen before in John. He says that he is the light of the world. Now, obviously in this context, he says that in part because what is he about to do? He's dealing with a man who is in darkness. He has never seen light his entire life, and he's going to heal him so that now he can see. And so light is going to enter his life for the first time. So to say he's the light of the world is a relevant thing to say given what he's about to do. But remember that when Jesus talks about being the light of the world, he's really talking about understanding, bringing light in the darkness, the darkness of our ignorance and foolishness. So Jesus, I think, is tying this miracle that he's about to do to the broader idea that he has come to open our eyes to the truths of God. And that, in fact, is what we're going to see in the story of this man born blind. He is not just healed of his blindness, but he truly comes to see. He truly comes to understand the truth. Let me make a brief comment before we go any further about this unusual statement that Jesus makes. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. I think this is a little bit of a side statement. It's not directly related to what it is he's about to do, but I think this comment is aimed in particular at his disciples. He says, we must work this work. Jesus is preparing them. As he's been going along, he has said various things to his disciples about what is going to happen to him and what ultimately they are going to be doing. I think here he's just again intimating to them that there is this hard time coming. Right now, it's still the daytime. I'm with you. We're doing this. We've come to this blind man. We're about to do an amazing thing in his life. But there is this time coming. The day is going to end, and the night is coming when it will not be possible to do work. The end of Jesus' ministry is coming, and he's going to be arrested, as has been threatened all along, and he's going to be executed, as been threatened all along. It's interesting, though, that very soon in John, we're going to see in the upper room discourse, Jesus is going to sit down with his disciples and explain to them that he is going, that his ministry is going to end, but that they, in fact, are going to continue that ministry, that the work will continue, only they are the ones who are going to continue it. So I just see this statement as a brief sort of preparatory statement to the disciples about what it is that's coming up. And we've seen these little hints all through John, and it, as we get more and more towards the end, this theme is going to emerge very much with very much more strength, because the time that Jesus is leaving is going to be coming. But for now, it's the time when Jesus is here, his work continues, he's the light of the world. He put mud on the man's eyes, the man goes to wash the mud off, and when he washes the mud off, he can see. And then he comes back, Jesus isn't there, but now, he, for the first time in his life, he can see. Now we have this opportunity to explore one of John's favorite themes, which is, how do people respond to Jesus doing a miracle? Jesus has done this sign, this amazing thing, in this blind man's life. So what do people do with it? What I'd like to do is read the whole rest of the chapter to you here to just get the story out, and then I want to highlight certain people's reactions as we see it. So we start in verse 8 and read the rest of the story through chapter 9 here. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It's he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." They brought him to the Pharisees, the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. And we all know that's a problem. So the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, "What did you say? What do you say about him, since he has opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But how he now sees, we don't know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age. Ask him." So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." He answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" And they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." The man answered, "Why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and would you teach us?" and they cast him out. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains." Okay, so let's look at some of the different reactions we have here. First of all, we see the reaction of the man's neighbors. They're confused. They have only known him as a blind beggar, so they can't believe their eyes. They see this guy. It looks like him, but he's not the way he was before. Now he can see. And so this keeps saying, "Well, no, it must be somebody else. It must be somebody that looks like him, because this isn't the same guy. He's blind. He's always been blind." And he has to keep telling them, no, really, it's me. I'm the guy. I'm that guy that was sitting on the corner blind." So they decide, "Well, let's take him to our religious leaders then. Let's take him to the Pharisees, and maybe they can tell us what's going on with this." Now, another reaction we see in this situation is the man's parents. Their testimony is important. People aren't believing that this is really what happened, so they can say, "No, trust us, we're his parents, this is our son. We know our own son when we see him. And yes, he has been blind since birth. We've been there the whole time. You can trust us. He has never seen his whole life." But they're afraid. That final question, "How did this happen to him?" We can tell from the way it's set up, they know the answer to this question. They know that Jesus is the one who did this. But in the Jerusalem area, a huge opposition to Jesus is setting in among the religious leaders there. As we've been reading for some time in John, they have been trying to arrest Jesus and they haven't been successful. But what they have done, at least, is in the local synagogues in the area, it is being talked up, "You stay away from this guy. You don't have anything to do with him." And the threat is that if you do have something to do with him, then we don't want to have anything to do with you. I don't think there's any evidence that this is a widespread thing that's happening throughout Judaism, but in the Jerusalem area, where there is this ferment, this unrest over Jesus and this desire to have him arrested, it would make sense that in those synagogues that the leaders there would be putting pressure on people to stay away from him. And to get kicked out of the synagogue would be a very serious thing. I mean, this would be the center of their social and religious life. I mean, you'd really lose your place in your community if you were to be kicked out of the synagogue. So even though you would think the parents would be incredibly grateful to Jesus and want to cry out to everyone, "Look at what this prophet from God has done for our son," the fact is they're afraid. They know if they do that, they're likely to get kicked out of the synagogue, and they don't want to. So they say, "Ask him. We don't know." They do know, but they say, "Well, don't talk to us. He's the one that happened to, so talk to him." Okay, so that brings us then to the two most important reactions in the story. We see the reaction of some of the Pharisees, and we see the reaction of the man himself, who is really kind of the hero of this story in a certain sense. I mean, Jesus is the hero of the story, probably in the deepest sense, but the man born blind is really an important and attractive figure, I think, in this story. Okay, so we have to remember Jesus is healed on the Sabbath. Once again, when he did this before, was enough to inspire some of the Jewish leaders to want to have him arrested and executed, and now here he is doing it again. But it's caused a division, we see. It's interesting that there's not a unanimous voice among the Pharisees. Some of the Pharisees are really upset that he has healed again on the Sabbath and saying he can't be from God. It can't be that he is from God because he's a Sabbath breaker. But others of the Pharisees are getting the idea. They're recognizing, look, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? These miracles are signs. They signify that God is with the person who's doing this. I mean, there is something to consider here. How are we to explain that this man can do these miracles? Yeah, okay, he's breaking the Sabbath, but we can't just stop at that. We have to come up with some explanation for what's going on with this. And so it says there's a division among the Pharisees. Some of them are kind of attracted to the idea that maybe something's going on here. And others of them are, no, he's a Sabbath breaker. He can't be from God. But as we can see ultimately in this story, there is an influential group of Pharisees in Jerusalem that ultimately win the day. The ones who are opposed to Jesus, who see him as a Sabbath breaker and a false teacher. So that's the situation that the man finds himself in. His religious community is kind of suspicious of what it is that has just happened to him. Now, I don't know how much to go into this. It's always worth trying to talk about, what exactly is the nature of the Pharisees' problem? Why is Jesus healing on the Sabbath such a problem to them? And what's wrong with their perspective? Why shouldn't it be? They're not wrong to understand that God in the Mosaic Covenant had commanded that the Jews keep the Sabbath. That's true. It had been required. And so you would think that the emphasis of the Pharisees on keeping the Sabbath would be a godly, obedient thing to do. But what's so important to understand in the way the New Testament explores the issue of obedience to the law is that there is a godly and appropriate way to obey the law, and there is an ungodly, disbelieving way to obey the law. And that's what Jesus has accused the Pharisees of. He has accused them of missing the point. They don't really understand what God is about. Jesus has to remind them in other places that God had said in the Old Testament that he desires mercy and not sacrifice. They have distorted the Sabbath and made it into something that God never intended. And they have made it this test that they use to judge whether someone else is right. We do it right. We know the correct rules to follow regarding the Sabbath, and anyone who does not follow those rules the way we do is obviously wrong. The result is, you can see how wrong-headed they are ultimately, is that the Messiah of God, the man who most fully embodies the moral will of God. This is God himself living out the life of a man before us, and they look at him and saying, you're doing it wrong. So something about their whole perspective of things has made it such that they can't see reality. They think they understand what it's about, but they don't. And that's where the battle is between Jesus and those Pharisees. It's a battle for, what is God's heart like? What does God really want? What is he calling us to? So, as the Pharisees are trying to deal with this man, okay, this story, Jesus, here's Jesus again on the Sabbath healing somebody. So they ask the man, so what do you think? You're the one whose eyes were opened, supposedly. Who do you think he is? And he speaks right up, hey, it seems obvious to me he's a prophet from God. What else would he be? But the Pharisees don't like that answer. They're looking for another way of understanding what's going on here. So they say, hey, well, maybe this is a fake. Let's get his parents. We'll find out from his parents that this story really doesn't hold water. But that doesn't work because his parents say, no, he's always been blind. And that's him. That's our kid right there. That guy that's seeing, he's never seen before. So that doesn't work. Clearly something has happened. So now they turn around, the Pharisees turn around and put pressure on the man. Give glory to God. We know this man, Jesus, is a sinner. Basically, they can't deny the miracle, so they try to assert their authority. Look, we have decided that there's something wrong with him. The Sabbath breaking and all of that stuff, clearly there's something wrong with him. We know that he is a sinner. So you need to submit to our judgment about this. I know you're all excited because you can see and everything, but if you would only look at things the way we're looking at things, you would recognize that, yeah, it's great, we're glad that you can see, but that can't be it. This guy isn't it. So the man gives what I think is a great answer to this pressure. It says, well, I don't know if he's a sinner or not. I just met him. But I do know that I used to be blind, and now I'm not. So deal with that. I mean, explain to me how it is that this has happened. So in response to this, the Pharisees, I mean, again, we can't deal directly with this because we have no answer to how this happened. So, all right, so tell us again, what did he do? And so the man gives what I think is quite a funny and perceptive answer. Why are you asking me again? I just told you this stuff. I mean, the answer is they're asking him again because they don't like the answer that they're getting. They keep hoping that they're going to get a different answer. So he says, well, you know, I told you this already. You're so interested, you keep asking this over and over again. You must want to be one of his disciples, right? Which I think he's being kind of snotty. I don't think he really thinks that's what they want, but he's kind of, I think he's putting his finger on the problem. Why aren't we done? Why don't you just say, wow, this is great. This guy from God healed you. He says, okay, we're not done yet, so there must be some explanation for that. This really ticks the Pharisees off, and they assert their authority again. We don't want to be his disciple. You're his disciple. We're disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but we don't know where this man comes from. And now, in a really amazing way, I think it really helps for us if we think about the situation that this blind beggar has been in all his life. He's speaking to his religious leaders. They have the power to kick him out of the synagogue, but he doesn't back down. He doesn't bow to them and say, okay, well, you know, I guess you guys know better. You are, you know, you're the pastor, so you must know what you're talking about. He boldly points out to them the inadequacy of their answer. You don't know where he came from? I think his answer is basically, I don't think it's that hard to figure out where he came from. I mean, he's come, he's claiming he's from God, and he healed me of my lifelong blindness. I mean, who else is he going to be? This is God only listens to people that God likes, right? And here's the power of God being displayed through this man. Why don't you know where he's from? I think is what he's saying. I know where he's from. He's made it clear where he's from. Well, the Pharisees respond with enthusiasm to this comment and by actually kicking him out of the synagogue, is what I understand it to be saying. They issue an edict. You're not one of us anymore. You're out. So what the parents had feared would happen to them has in fact happened to their son. He won't back down. He insists that Jesus has done this thing and that it shows that he's from God. And as a result, the Pharisees, they have no answer. Notice they still haven't answered the issue that he's raising, but they just assert their authority. We don't have to listen to this. So now Jesus hears what has happened. It comes back to him that the man that he had healed has been kicked out of the synagogue because he would not back down in his insistence that Jesus is a prophet from God who has healed him. So Jesus seeks him out. And he basically explores this question with him. Given all that's happened, do you believe in the Son of Man? he says. And I think what he's saying basically is, look, I'm telling you that the Son of Man, the Messiah, is here. Are you ready to believe in him? And the man has already come to believe that Jesus is a prophet from God, that God is behind this great miracle that he's done. So he's prepared to trust him and believe him. But he asked the question, I'm not sure if he's just being cautious or if he hasn't quite caught on yet, but he asks the question, yeah, who is he? I'm ready to believe in the Son of Man. You, who I trust, you tell me, who is the Son of Man that I should believe in him? And Jesus says to him, you have seen him, which is a very poignant sort of answer to give because he's only been seeing for like a half an hour or something in his whole life. But he's saying, those eyes that have just started working, you, those eyes have seen the Son of Man that I'm talking about. And in fact, it's me. I, the one who healed you, I am that Son of Man. I'm the Messiah. I'm the one from God who has come to save the world. And the man responds to that in belief. He says, I believe you, that you are who you say you are. And it says that he worshiped him, which I understand to mean, we have to understand that this word worship really captures, if you picture those old medieval knight kind of movies where it's like in Robin Hood, you know, if you've ever seen the old Robin Hood movie, which is a great movie, Errol Flynn and all that stuff. I really love that movie. It's one of my favorite swashbuckling movies. So in the end of the movie, King Richard reveals himself. He throws off his cloak and everyone sees it's the king. And what Robin Hood and all of the his merry men, they all go down on one knee and bow their head. They're making this acknowledgement. You are our king. You are our superior. You're more important than I am. And I think that's the image that we are to see here. He worshiped him. It's not that he started, you know, singing a praise song or something like that. It's that he made this movement to acknowledge, you are claiming to be the king sent from God, and I believe you. That's who I'm. I am bowing myself before you to acknowledge that's who you are. Okay, so given all that's just happened, Jesus makes kind of a summary statement in verse 39. For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. Jesus is using language in a very rich way here, I think. He has just literally healed a man who physically could not see. But clearly at this point, he's using the language metaphorically to talk about the real issue, whether a person sees and understands the truth. He has come so that those who are blind might see. The man born blind was like the rest of us. He was also spiritually blind. He didn't know how to save himself. He probably didn't really even understand what his problem is or how to even go about such a thing. But Jesus has brought him sight in both senses. He can physically see, but in this process, he has come to understand who it is that he's dealing with, that Jesus is the one sent from God that can actually bring him salvation. This is John's classic theme that we're recognized, a miraculous sign followed by belief in someone who has come to understand what that sign meant. The Pharisees in this situation, though, are just the opposite. They think they see. They have their religious system, and their rules say that Jesus is a Sabbath breaker who can't be from God. They've already got it figured out. Look, this guy can't be from God because we know how this stuff works. And as we've seen, in almost a humorous way, this whole story shows how they're convinced that they're right. They're so convinced that they're right that they keep turning from one side to the other to try to avoid facing into the clear implications of what has happened. They don't want to go there. They're so convinced that they understand things that they can't see what's right in front of them. And that's the irony that Jesus is exploring here in his language. If you were blind, you would have no guilt. The blind man was blind in both senses. He couldn't see, but he was also spiritually blind, like everyone else. But he didn't fight the truths that Jesus was showing him. He didn't claim to understand better than what Jesus did, what things were about. But the Pharisees thought they see. And in doing so, it actually meant that they were blind. They were stubbornly blind. They insisted that they could see quite well. And that's the difference. All of us are sinners, but some of us are so committed to being sinners that we can't see the truth of the things in front of us because we've decided that things are the way we understand them to be. Now, we're not done here. Notice that although we have a chapter break here, if you look at the first line in chapter 10, truly, truly, I say to you, I mean, Jesus isn't done talking. We're still in the same conversation here. And what we're about to see about the good shepherd and all of that kind of stuff is a continuation of this dialogue that he's having. The last thing he said to the Pharisees was talking to them about their blindness and their guilt. And now we're continuing on in that discussion. And I want to look at a little bit of this just briefly. Starting in 10:1. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of a stranger. This figure of speech Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. Okay, now I have a very simple observation to make about this. I think, from my perspective, although it's not hard to understand what Jesus is talking about here, the key to understanding where this stuff is coming from is to see this. Remember that this is tied to all the stuff that just happened in chapter 9. This is a continuation of what he's saying to the Pharisees, and that basically this is a commentary on what just happened. Jesus is the true shepherd of the sheep. The Pharisees are the thieves and robbers, the stranger that the sheep will not follow. The blind man is one of the sheep. And he showed that he was one of Jesus' flock by ignoring the Pharisees and listening to Jesus. This question of who are you going to listen to, this has just been played out in the story that we just saw. The Pharisees were exerting all of their authority in his life. They're the ones who have been his teachers. They're the ones who speak for the law. And they're telling him, back off. Get away from this guy. Listen to us. He's a sinner. Don't buy into this. And yet, he didn't listen. He didn't respond to them. He spoke back to them. There's something wrong with what you're saying here. But when Jesus told him, I'm the Messiah, he listened to him and he believed him. And I think that's what's behind this little story, this little image, analogy that Jesus gives. Think about the pressure that this guy was under. These have been his religious leaders his whole life. They're ready to throw him out of the synagogue if he doesn't knuckle under. His parents are too afraid to even admit that Jesus did this because they're afraid that they're going to get kicked out. And yet he stands fast. Jesus is a prophet. He healed me. And he ultimately listens to what Jesus has to say. The thieves and robbers were trying to climb in over the fence, but this particular sheep said, I don't recognize your voice. You're not the one that I'm going to listen to. Jesus is clearly the one I need to pay attention to. So Jesus' analogy here shows exactly where everyone stands. We know that the blind man was one of Jesus' flock because he responded to his call. He heard his voice. And we know that the Pharisees are false teachers. because the blind man turned away from them when they tried to pull him away from Jesus and said, no, that's not right. And they turned to Jesus instead. Okay, so Jesus changes the analogy a little bit now. In verse 7, so Jesus again said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. So, in this picture, the Pharisees are still thieves that the sheep will not listen to, but now Jesus, instead of being the shepherd, is the door, the means that the sheep have to find pasture. How are they going to arrive, these sheep, at those fields where all their needs will be taken care of? They can graze in the pasture all they want. Well, Jesus is the door through which they can go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes to steal and kill. Jesus came to give life and abundance. The thief comes to take away. Jesus came to give. Again, this is a harsh criticism of the Pharisees. Their teaching will not lead to life, but to death and destruction. And we can see that in what just happened. They were busy trying to pull the man away from the one who could give him life. They were insistent, don't listen to that. Listen to us. And if he had listened to them, he would have ended up with nothing. Jesus is the door to life, and they were trying to close that door. Okay, then finally in verse 11, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. And I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father. Now, there's a lot we could talk about here, but I just want to highlight one thing, and then we'll finish things up. Here, he's made the analogy again now. First, he was the shepherd, then he was the door, and now he's the shepherd again. The first time, he was the shepherd in the sense that his sheep recognize his voice. He was the real shepherd because his sheep will go with him, and they're not going to listen to somebody else. This time, he's the real shepherd because fake shepherds, when the wolf comes, they think of their own neck and they run. Whereas the real shepherd cares for the sheep. They are his, and he gives up his life for them. Which, of course, Jesus is pointing ultimately ahead to the cross, where he is actually literally going to lay down his life to save his flock. Okay, so I'm just going to let that go with that. There are some other interesting things in there, but I just wanted to point out in this section that basically what we have is this commentary on what's just happened, that we have this choice that the blind man had to make. Which voice is he going to listen to? Who's the true shepherd here? And in the end, he chose to listen to Jesus. Okay, so I just have a couple of concluding comments. First of all, I want to get back to that thing in the beginning. Jesus made this statement that the man was born blind, that the works of God might be displayed in him. Jesus here is providing authoritative commentary on this man's life, which we would all like to have. We would love to have God come along and say, let me tell you why it is that you're going through the things that you're going through. We don't usually have that commentary. But we see here a confirmation, at least, of the way that God tends to do things. God is quite willing to put us through what seem to us to be very difficult circumstances in order to accomplish his greater purposes. And what are those greater purposes here? Well, first of all, it would be easy to say he was born blind so that the Messiah could come along and do an obvious miracle. Now he sees. Everyone can testify. This man has never seen in his entire life, and now he does. So in that sense, his life has been a preparation for this miracle that Jesus does. But it's important for us to remember that a greater work was being done here as well, that ultimately Jesus' language about giving sight to the blind and being the light of the world is not about physical sight, but it is about the understanding that leads to life, to bring light into a person's life so that they might actually embrace the truth and find life. And that's what happened in the life of the blind man in this story, that when he said, "I believe," at the end, that's the real miracle, that's the real sight that really counts. If he had continued to be blind his whole life, that wouldn't have been a tragedy in the sense that if he had said, "No, I don't believe," and had listened to the Pharisees instead, that would have been the real tragedy. So this work that Jesus did in his life, the way that his blindness prepared for this work that was done, was not just so that Jesus could do a trick and everyone could say, "Wow, that was a neat trick," but there was a serious and profound work in his life that his blindness had prepared him for. So I think that's important for us to understand. As we think about how God is dealing with our lives, we need to have the whole picture. That, yes, on the one hand, God means business, and he is quite prepared to take us through difficult and serious circumstances to accomplish his purposes. But on the other hand, we have been assured that his purposes are redemptive, that ultimately the point of all of it is to bring us to life. And so in that sense, we're like the blind man. Each of us here is like that blind man. That's what we are counting on God to do. Secondly, I'd like to just make a comment about what Jesus says here, this image of "my sheep hear my voice." This fits very well with the theme that we have been seeing in John. There's this gap between unbelief and belief. And unbelief is rooted in things that I don't want to give up, and an unwillingness to admit that I am a sinner, and we've seen a variety of things there. And on the other hand, we've seen belief rooted in a new birth that has come from the Spirit of God. It is God the Father calling us to Christ, and only those who are called by the Father will come to him, and so on. And now here we see this language of there are those who will hear the voice of the shepherd. Jesus' message will hit home, and they will respond to it, and it is those who are his sheep. If we peek ahead to the next dialogue later in 10:26, Jesus says to the Pharisees, "But you do not believe because you are not of my sheep." I mean, it is ultimately dependent on what sort of a person are you? What is God doing in your life ultimately that's going to determine where you end up with this? And we see this choice, the voices that we have to listen to. The blind man's religious leaders are telling him that their model of Sabbath keeping is the standard by which everything must be judged. Jesus can't be from God because he doesn't fit our model. He's violating the rules that we have determined are the standard by which you judge whether someone is godly or not. But on the other hand, we have Jesus himself showing himself to be a messenger from God through the signs that God is doing with him, and he has called on the blind man to believe in him, to see what he has done and recognize, "I'm the one." These are these two voices that the blind man is having to sort out. And I just wanted to emphasize that for us, it's important for us to understand that this is not a Jewish issue that we're talking about here. It's the Sabbath happens to be the issue, but that's not really fundamentally what's at stake. I am very convinced that one of the fundamental religious impulses of human beings is towards self-righteousness. It is towards being able to establish that there are certain things that you must do and must not do, and if you can measure yourself by that standard, then you're okay. And Christianity has always had those voices amongst all the voices that we hear. Christianity is not exempt from this. Christianity is a religion. It has beliefs, things you're supposed to believe. It has things that people say you're supposed to do and things that you're not supposed to do. And it is always tempting, and it has always happened throughout history, that people have fallen into the same trap of basically saying, I can tell that I'm one of the good guys because I have the right set of beliefs and I do the right practices and I don't do those other things. And it's important for us, as we recognize that those voices are out there, that we have to decide whether we're going to listen to the voice of the shepherd, which is saying instead, you're a sinner, you need the mercy of God. You are never going to justify yourself before God on the basis of your superior religious performance. It is because God has shown mercy on you that you will enter into life. And that we hear that voice and recognize it and say, yeah, that's the truth. That's what it's about. I have one last comment to make here. I have to say this. Maybe you guys don't run into this. I don't actually hear this as much anymore, but then I'm not listening to a lot of those voices out there. But I remember when I first became a Christian, I received a lot of teaching about the abundant life. Jesus uses the language here, I have come that they may have life and have it abundantly. This is the way it's translated there, or literally, that they might have life and might have abundance. When I was a young Christian, the way this was taught to me was as kind of a challenge. Look, Jesus came to give you abundant life, a life overflowing with goodness. And I mean, abundance, it's that overflowing. I have so much that I can't even take it in. You know, things are so great that I can't even process how great everything is. So if your life is not so great, then there must be something wrong with you. Because Jesus came to bring abundant life. And if you don't have abundant life, then there must be something wrong. Maybe you don't have enough faith. Maybe you're not praying enough. Maybe you need to be practicing spiritual disciplines. And there would be a variety of answers as to why it is that you are suffering. Your life is not the glorious, rich life that Jesus has promised. So Jesus promised that he has come to bring abundant life and ended up being kind of a stick that people would get beat with, that you don't seem to have an abundant life. What's your problem? Because if you had really gotten what Jesus had to give, then you would be having all this abundance as well. Well, I just wanted to emphasize that I think this is profoundly misunderstanding what Jesus is getting at here. That yes, he came to bring life, as he's been talking about throughout this, eternal life. And eternal life brings with it abundance. That is, I am not going to lose, but I am going to gain. What Jesus has come to bring us is fullness and richness. We are going to live in the deepest sense. He doesn't really specify what that abundance is here, but we know from the rest of his teaching and the rest of the Bible the kind of thing that he's talking about. It is a life filled with everything that makes life worth living. We will know God. We will be freed from our own sin, as he has been talking about. There will be no sin left anywhere in creation. Nothing will stain our experience anymore. There will be no more shame. Instead, we will be glorious and know ourselves to be glorious because God has made us that way. We will love each other and be loved by each other. There will be no more death, and so on. I mean, all of that is the abundance that Jesus has come to bring. And every single one of his flock receive that abundance. Jesus made it clear that in this life there will be hardships. He said it often. Things can be tough in this life for my followers. And he didn't claim that it was otherwise. Nonetheless, he's saying, I have come to bring my people life and abundance. So we shouldn't let this be a stick to beat anyone up. Life is hard, I think. I find it to be hard. And I don't think that indicates that somehow I'm a second-class believer because I find life to be hard. I think if you're looking at it clearly, you understand that there are things about life that are hard. But Jesus is the Savior. He's the one that came to rescue us from all of this stuff. And that is for everyone. That's a guarantee. If you, like the blind man, have bowed the knee and said, you're the one, I'm looking to you, he will deliver. I mean, that's what he's promising, I think. So I just think it's important that we not get the wrong idea about that. Okay, so I've got a few minutes for any comments or questions you might have. Bob, your hand flew up. So let's go to Bob right away.
Thank you, Ron. That was really good. There's a statement in verse 18 that raises an issue for me. And
10:18.
Sorry. That I just puzzle over sometimes, and I'm wondering what you even think of the issue, if it's even worth puzzling over, or maybe it's so trivial or meaningless that I shouldn't even worry about it. He says, I have authority to lay my life down, and I have authority to take it up again. Which I see conflicting statements or statements that seem to go two different directions about Jesus' authority versus God's work. You know, and earlier Jesus said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Mm-hmm. But then you read that God is the one who raised Jesus. And then right. We've heard teaching previously from one of the other teachers about, you know, Jesus does a miracle, but it's not really Jesus doing it, it's God doing it. But then you have the woman touching his garment, and Jesus feels the power go out from him. And is that even an issue that's worth wrestling with, where the power is coming from, who's doing it?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Ron.
Yeah. Okay, so here, let me, as part of my answer, a little bit later in chapter 10, he says, starting in 27, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and they shall never perish. And no one shall snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. I and the Father are one. Okay, so we have Jesus deliberately kind of playing on that, I'm not going to let anybody take them. He's not going to let anybody take them. We're one. Okay, now, I think it's important to understand at this spot that when he says something like that, that his emphasis is on the idea that the Father and I are in this together. It's not like I'm pulling this way and he's pulling that way. That is, we are working the same thing. So I think we see Jesus often, I mean, I did this, the Father did this. I did this thing, but I'm doing the works that the Father has shown me to do, and all of that. I think the emphasis in these kinds of statements is what is Jesus emphasizing that he can say, what I set my hand to do will get done because I and the Father are one. I'm not going off trying to figure out something else and say, I've got my own power Father, you may be over there, but I'm going to go do this thing instead. I mean, they are working together. However you picture the relationship between Jesus and the Father, what he's saying there is we are working together in this thing. So that's what I understand him to be saying. And his emphasis there on the authority in this situation, I think what he's trying to say is he's talking about, I lay down my life for the sheep. Well, in part, as we look at what's about to happen, you might say, you didn't lay down your life, you got arrested. You got caught, you know. It's like a criminal saying, I gladly give my body to the county jail. And you go, no, you don't. You got caught. If he hadn't gotten caught, you wouldn't have given your body to anything. You would have gone home and spent your loot. So I think what Jesus is trying to get at with that kind of statement is, no, there's nobody out there. I mean, they've wanted to arrest him all this time, but they haven't. He's saying that ultimately, I'm the one who's in charge of this stuff, that it is my decision when it is I'm going to be arrested, and it's nobody else really has the power, because God ultimately has the power in all of this stuff, and we're one, we're together in this. So that's where his emphasis is, and I don't think he's answering the question one way or the other, how do I picture the particular source of the power at the moment or something like that? And those questions are really hard to answer, I think, because it's rarely the purpose of these kinds of statements to answer those kinds of questions. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for your talk.
You're welcome.
I have a question about 9:6. There's just like these strange moments in the Gospels where Jesus uses like his spit to do miracles. So I think there's like another, and I think it's Mark, like when the gentleman thinks he sees trees that like people or something. But I'm wondering if you have any insights into what's going on there.
No, you know, I mean, I've read people make comments about that sort of thing, speculating. People make comments about what cultural significance there might have been to that at the time. I don't have a good answer to that. I've wondered that myself, if it's just an arbitrary sort of thing or if people would have understood that in a certain way. And I don't really know, but that's a good question. Sorry.
No, that's okay. If anyone else knows anything, come talk to me later.
I personally don't use spit as a major spiritual tool, so if anybody wants to talk to me later, you'll be safe. But okay,
thank you. What you were saying at the end about the abundant life and stuff, I was also thinking about how I've known a couple people with disabilities or real hardships, and this same idea of, you know, you should be doing something more, you know, in the Christian life. I think what I noticed, sometimes either people will come to this conclusion for the person, or they come to themselves that, well, I'm trying to figure this out still my whole life. It's this thing isn't going away, but maybe this is so that God will, I'm just waiting for God to do this miracle and take this away so that other people will become Christians. And I think it's interesting, I really like that you brought out this individual in this story who the miracle got his attention because Jesus was right there. And there's some way, I mean, that this has come to be someone thinking, you know, well, we've got to get the attention of the world, and this is, I'm just waiting for God to do this. But it takes away something that could be their, their deeper understanding of, of what's going on. And like you say, you could have a life that is significant, but somehow we take away that significance when we're just, oh, you're just waiting for.
Yeah. No, it's true. Because being a person of faith in the midst of a difficult life that never, with some sort of problem that never gets resolved in this life, that in and of itself can be a very significant and meaningful thing for the world to see. I mean, it's not for me to tell God what message he's supposed to send the world with my life. I mean, that's ultimately up to him. And as we can see here, the miracle got the blind man's attention, but it didn't seem to do much for the rest of the folks around. They saw it, but they didn't see it. So, yeah. Dave, did you have your hand up? Yeah, let's do that. We'll make this the last one.
Thanks very much. Very clear as usual. Appreciate it a lot. I may have missed something, but it seems like in the interchanges between the Pharisees and the man born blind, it seemed as though they were. It seemed to be taken for granted that the fact that the man's sight was now, he now had sight, was a validation of Jesus in some way, that he was good and truly of God and that kind of thing. Does that seem to be what they were?
Yeah, in some way. I mean, I know where you're going here, and
how do you?
I'm preparing myself to backpedal. So
oh, okay. Well, no, there's no accusation coming.
No. Go ahead.
It's a genuine curiosity. I guess the question would be: would they have thought that there could have been any other reason for someone for a miracle other than that this truly is God? And then beyond that, these days, do you suppose there are sources other than divine sources for when physical laws are set aside for God's purposes?
Yeah, that's an important distinction, and I think that's why sometimes I remember when in talking about this to couple the signs, the miracles, with the rest of what they had to work with. I mean, Jesus pointed to the scriptures as confirmation that what he was doing was what they should have expected the Messiah to be about. And I think would point to the wisdom and the congruence between what he teaches, his ethical teaching, his theological teaching, and what the Bible said. There is a possibility that I shouldn't just believe that somebody, I ought to listen to somebody because something remarkable has happened, that there's more to it than that. But I think Jesus would paint the picture, you know, in the last one we looked at, it's not only that he has done signs, but he used that language, which of you can accuse me of wrong? I mean, why would you reject me? What are you pointing to? Except for the Sabbath deal, which is this unique kind of issue, which he has addressed in his teaching and explained to them, this is why you're not seeing it right. But if in fact what's behind what he's doing, I mean, we see in the other Gospels that there is a point at which they say he's doing this by the power of Beelzebub. You know, and Jesus argues, I don't think that makes sense. You can say that, but it doesn't really make sense of what we're looking at here. And I think it's that whole package, ultimately, that we would have to recognize. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen in the end, but Jesus makes a warning about false signs, and Paul seems to make a warning about false signs in conjunction with what he calls the Antichrist, and it all depends on how you interpret that stuff and what you think's going on with that, which is real hard, and I'm not going to go into that stuff because it's really hard. But the fact is, I have to be prepared for the fact that something could happen in the world, somebody could come along preaching something that is in essence the antithesis to the gospel, something that is an alternative to the gospel, and back it up with amazing things. And just because they're amazing things, I don't want to look at them. So, yeah, they could make an alternative proposal, but the question is, given everything that you find there, the scriptures, his congruence with the scriptures, his wisdom, his understanding, and the fact that God is behind what he's saying. All of that, then, to reject him because he hasn't kept the Sabbath shows a profound lack of understanding of what it is that you're looking at. But yeah, that's a good question to raise. Okay, so we'll stop with that then.